You highlighted yesterday that every person is you, the self. When we converse with others, we are talking to ourselves. Well, again, at the ego level, you're talking to a projection. If you have realized the one self, then there will no longer be identification as a person. So my question is, how does one deal with others or parts of the self that you feel a need to let go of, like friends who keep alive old patterns and sanskaras? Is it cruel or damaging to your own self to simply let go of these people? I have recently started turning away from my last few external handful of friends. You mentioned Karuna at the start of the retreat, and this threw me, because is it uncaring or uncompassionate to let go of these people or parts of the self? It's all illusory anyway, right? So when I conceptualize Mahasukha or meditate on Santosha, I feel that no individual matters, including this false self. Okay, well, there's a lot of, premises that are embedded in that bit of discourse. So the first thing to understand is, at the ego level, you are not seeing those others as they are. You're seeing their what you are projecting, and seeing them through the lens of those projections and preconceptions. Your ego mind will also subconsciously be provoking them to act in ways that correspond to your projections. Right? So if I think there's someone angry at me, they may not be, but I can act in a way that will get them angry at me very quickly. And then I say, see, I knew it, you see, but you actually created it and then deceived yourself that you were very perceptive about that person. But in fact, it was just a play, and the joke was on you, not on reality. So, it's letting go of your beliefs about the other that is what is important. I have found in the life of this being, never having to reject anyone. But when I speak truth to them, they often will run away from me and not come back into my life. But I have never had to treat anyone else with a rejection slip. However, I've been rejected probably by more people than you've ever met, you know. But nonetheless, whoever is attracted magnetically to that vibrational frequency, those should be and will be the ones that are meant to have relational connections. So therefore, I think that this is actually a pseudo-problem. And the real karuna has to be your care for who you really are, and the divine love has to flow through you. And when your divine love flows through you unconditionally, you won't reject anyone or anything, and you will see it's all perfect. Okay. Next question. Where does one go when one gains access to the imaginary plane? Now, I'm not sure what you mean by imaginary plane, because when here we speak of the imaginary, we mean the ego. The ego is in the imaginary register because it sees its imagination, its projections. But I think what you may mean is the imaginal plane, which is different. That's the plane that mystics like Ibn Arabi would speak about. The great Sufi mystics who worked in a plane of visions and were able to receive visions that are in a way kind of waking dreams that come from the divine consciousness that were then able to be turned into stories and narratives about the prophets and understandings of the unfoldment of the world process from an archetypal level. And so if you're asking about gaining access to that, it requires surrendering in particular to the archetypal intelligence of the God Self. Okay, so, but the main problem for one in ego consciousness is getting out of the imaginary plane into the real. Okay, here's a strange question. Today at midday, did we partake in a local and virtual instance of Shaktipat being shared by the guru? Well, there's only one guru, that's the Sadguru, that is Shiva, and Shiva is not local. And Shaktipat is not virtual, it's very actual and very real in real one as well as real two and real three. So whatever might have happened to this individual in terms of feeling Shaktipat, this is only a function of your relationship to Shiva and whatever surrender that your heart is able to offer to the presence, to being the temple for the presence of God. Okay, so the next question seems very simple. It's what is beauty? But it could write a book. In fact, libraries of books have been written about the question of what is beauty. So it's not so easy to answer that one. But what comes to me first is the mantra, let's call it, in India, of Satyam Shivam Sundaram. So Sundaram means divine beauty. Satyam means truth, God's truth. Satyam is the God Self, or Shivam. And it's Shivam, not Shiva, because it's the principle of Shiva that can be downloaded by any individual node of consciousness. Beauty is the divine nature itself, which is formless. Real beauty is not the beauty of a form. Okay, that's a lower kind of beauty. Real beauty is, and the word for beauty in German is what? Schöne, right? It means shining, right? It's the shining light of the divine consciousness through you that enables you to perceive that beauty, that divine light. That's the original and ultimate meaning of it. It may now no longer be signifying that because signifieds slide under the signifier in different languages, but that's its meaning. However, remember, truth is also beautiful. Truth is not different. Do you remember the famous poem by Keats, Ode on a Grecian Urn? It ends with the lines, truth is beauty and beauty truth. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. And so that's very important because truth itself is beautiful and you need them both for beauty to become fully aware of its true nature. You need the wisdom of truth to enlighten the beautiful and for the beautiful to recognize that it is beautiful because it is filled with truth and the power of truth. So, but then if we get to this question of truth even more deeply, we encounter Plato's theory of beauty, and Plato's theory still, to me, holds validity. And his theory is beauty descends from the ideas, the archetypal ideas. It's often now, I think, badly translated as forms, but the archetypal beauty is not necessarily the beauty of form, because there is abstract beauty. There is the beauty of ideas itself that is different from from the beauty of form. And once you get into the beauty of form, that form, whatever form you see in the phenomenal world, is no longer the archetypal form in its direct true nature, but it's a version, a simulacrum, a copy of a copy of the original archetypal beauty. And so it only has a certain diluted percentage of the actual beauty. And we could say that as consciousness degrades in Kali Yuga, the beauty of form becomes reduced to eye candy, you know, that one sees forms that are glamorous and produce desire. And that's probably the lowest form of beauty. But then you also have very classical, high cultural, sensory symbolic beauty in which the beauty is, let's not say eye candy, but dessert wine for the senses. You know, it's a beauty that is it refers symbolically to the presence of the divine that is shining through the form. But then you have symbolic beauty in a very abstract way. Like there's mathematical beauty, and there's the beauty of logic. You know, I remember days when long ago I used to be into playing chess, and I would find the games that were being played at that moment by the international grandmasters in tournaments. And there was always a brilliancy prize given for the most brilliant game in a tournament. And I used to, you know, get the text of the game and play it out to see if I could figure out the brilliant move ahead of time of the grandmaster. So, and there was an incredible beauty of the genius of someone who could have seen, you know, 10 moves ahead, how to arrange a situation where there'd be a forced checkmate or whatever. But there was a beauty in the capacity to strategically and logically achieve a recognition of something that was extremely non-obvious to anyone who didn't have a vision of the logos of the entire game board. So in any case, there are all of those kinds of beauty, and probably many others. I think the general capacity to recognize the beauty of paintings and music and other forms of art requires the cultivation of the embedded meaningfulness, even meaning moreness, that constitutes a work of art. That what is being represented or being shown that isn't a representation, in modern art there's very little representationalism any longer, but what is being shown offers to the one who is able to perceive it with an eye that is cultured enough to connect the dots that may be subliminal or hidden or embedded in layers of various possible meanings, and to grasp the let's say the superposition of all of those aspects of meaning that the artist may or may not have known that they were putting into the work of art, because a connoisseur of art may see more than the artist who made it, right? But that beauty in the eye of the beholder is something that has to be learned and developed through a growth of one's depth and nuances of consciousness and feeling. So we could probably go on and develop other forms of beauty, but in the ultimate sense, again, I would come back to the divine nature that is truth and light and brilliant intelligence and love and care and purity and goodness, all of that are the aspects of beauty. I don't know if I answered the question, but that's how I would probably approach it. Can paranormal experience be blocked because of psychological reasons? Yes, that's simple. Not even multiple psychedelic mushroom ingestions have shown me anything outside of the ordinary. I know lots of people who have that situation. Even though I've experienced some profound synchronicities, deeper understanding of the spiritual world and heightened intuition, things like out-of-body experiences, astral traveling, and the psychedelic visuals still feel fictional to me. They are fictional. As far as I know, my conscious mind doesn't have the fear anymore. Is there something here for me to explore, or should I just ignore the lack of such experiences? Okay. I think this is an important point to talk about because a lot of people are confused and believe that a psychedelic experience, whether it's psilocybin or DMT or some other substance, MDMA or ketamine, there's so many different varieties now of altered states that you can choose from, like flavors of ice cream, but all of them, if you are in the ego when you ingest it, what will be the outcome of what you perceive will be the projections of your ego, the conscious and the subconscious together, possibly with some superconscious information, but that superconscious information will be filtered through the ego interpretation mechanism. And so no one ever becomes liberated through the use of those substances. No one, even though I've heard the story many times from people, I went through ego death on ayahuasca or something, they're all in their egos when they're telling me this. It's an illusion. You can't do it. You go in with an ego, and that ego may indeed experience a paranormal phenomena, but that will not raise one out of ego itself, because the ego is the one going through that impurience that's being activated by the shifts of brain functioning that are being produced temporarily by those chemicals. So it can be useful. I don't say it doesn't have therapeutic value for some, and some when it's used by shamans in the right way, then it can have healing value and other kinds of values for a tribe. Of remote viewing or whatever might be necessary to know where the cows went off to so you can find them, or where the bananas are located or whatever. But, you know, or what are the evil spirits in the area? You can perceive those, but you're still going to be perceiving it from the egoic level unless you have, before you take it, have already reached a higher state of consciousness and then can direct the use of it rather than being subject to the hallucinatory information that arises. So I think that whoever asked the question is actually being saved from a situation in which you could easily get attached to such kinds of experiences, which is why the sages all recommend that those who are practicing meditation, who may have paranormal experiences or experiences as a result of meditative practice alone, don't get hooked on that, because you want liberation. You don't want to just have some story you can impress others with, or abilities to do things within the phenomenal plane that have some kind of impressive magical aura around them, because they are still within that field of illusion. And what you really want is liberation from that. These substances may be able to be used for some, not for everyone, in that process. But ultimately, as Terence McKenna found, nothing was achieved with all of the hundreds of mushroom and DMT trips that he took, and he finally stopped toward the end of his life, long before he got the diagnosis of the brain tumor. He had already said, no, it was a dead end. Useful to some extent, but most of what his very brilliant mind spoke about in terms of the changes that society were going through, he didn't get from the drugs. He got from reading history and alchemy and philosophy, and was able to put that together through his reason. He had a very strong capacity for reasoning. So I think it's very important not to to want those things. If it is God's will that certain powers be given siddhis, then it will happen as it's meant to be. Okay, I hope that's helpful. Is the current yuga that we are heading into, the Kali Yuga? No, we're coming out of that. Are we somehow past that already? No, we're in it, but we're in it superposed with Sangam Yuga. But we're not heading into it, we're in it. How does this relate to time wave zero that Terence McKenna talks about? Then the coming singularity, is this related to AI as Kurzweil thinks? No. McKenna's transcendental object at the end of time, the singularity he's referring to there, is the cosmic singularity. That term singularity originally came from the field of cosmology and referred to the Big Bang, the infinitely dense point of light that went bang and created the cosmos, theoretically. That's the singularity. In fact, it's not really that. It's the divine light of God that then bursts out with a new cycle of time as an energy pulse of spanda. But I think he was on to the fact that we were approaching the end of time, not another yuga, at least not until we go through the singularity, and then it's a new sat yuga. So I hope that makes it clear. His time wave zero, no, I think that was a fantasy in which he tried to employ the I Ching to understand historical events, and I think that one was a bit of a dud, but his general approach, I think, was accurate. Okay, here's a long one. Let me see if I can shorten this. The insidious nature of ego masquerading as the self seems to be getting the best of me. But if you know that, then it isn't getting the best of you. If you recognize that that's what's happening, then you simply have to make an ethical choice not to continue deceiving yourself. Could you please give some suggestions on how to be courageously and wholeheartedly the spiritual hero? See, there's the problem. Don't try to be a spiritual hero. The real hero is the zero, okay? You have to flatline the idea of being a me, whether it's a heroic me or a cowardly me, but the me itself is the problem. Don't try to create a heroic version of the ego. The heroism comes in the having the courage to eliminate the me and the mind. Both conscious and unconscious fears of the ego make it very challenging to discern. Yes, exactly. And leave its sliver of identity completely behind to embrace the unknown fully. But you see, it's unknown only to the ego because the ego doesn't know the real. It's fictional, and it cannot know the real. The problem is, don't identify with the fear. The fear, just as the hope of being a hero, are part of the illusion. And once you stop fooling yourself with the fear, in the same way that you fool yourself with the megalomaniac idea that you are the self when you're still the ego, both of these are clearly false and easy to let go of once you see that they don't pertain to the self. So, again, your question, the next sentence, how can one shift from seeing the process of shedding the ego from something scary to something joyous and jump off the cliff with absolute bravery and faith that Shiva and Shakti will unite and catch us? Okay, but again, that's a narrative. There is no actual cliff that you have to jump off, all right? I think that should be very clear to people. You are already there. There is no cliff. There's only the void. It's all only emptiness. You're even imagining that you're on a cliff that you can choose to jump off or not. There is no cliff. There is no ground. It's all just light, and it's your own intelligence that's creating this illusion that you are somebody who needs to be caught and saved from falling into the infinite void. That's where we are now. But that void is filled with light and joy already. It's not that you have to reach it. So you're fooling yourself with being scared as well as with the other side. Is divine will our dharma that the soul must follow? Well, it's not your dharma, but it's a command of the playwright to fulfill your destiny. It's ordained by a higher power than the ego. At times I feel like it is already written in the stars, in a sense, but I'm trying so hard in striving to be the self, to be self-realized, when instead perhaps I should relax and ease into silence. Yes. And then my inherent Mahasukha will naturally emerge. That's correct. So you see, you knew everything. You didn't have to ask me any of this. You know, why'd you waste our time when you could have gone to the bottom line and been already liberated? But everyone, you know, enjoys their narrative of suffering and agony and tragedy, and right? So this is what makes life interesting for the ego. So that's what their people are attached to. And then you can, you know, write your biography of how you overcame it and jumped off the cliff and make a lot of money and, you know, never actually jump. Okay. Is the conspiracy theory around the calcification of the pineal gland valid? Also, I was listening to specific frequencies that can have positive effect. 741 hertz is my jam. Okay. If anyone wants to make use of that, I have no idea about it. I think the calcification is actually a reality thanks to fluoride and other kinds of things that have been put in to weaken the organisms. But that will not affect the ability of the light to mobilize the energy of that and all of the organ systems to function at a higher vibrational frequency. So it's not really a problem. Okay, last one, it seems. Okay, I'm going to skip some of it that is talking about how much they got out of certain things, like the explanation of the invocation. I'm glad that that was helpful. But strange enough, the last 3 weeks, I somehow forgot the Sunday meditation, and I was puzzled about how and why I could do that three times in a row. Is this the ego that resists being exposed to the power of that invocation? Not necessarily, but it certainly resists the information in general, no doubt. Or can it be too powerful for the system, for the ego system, but not for the biological system? So, yes, there is resistance. Every ego resists. In particular, what is resisted is reaching silence. Because, as you see, the love of narratives, the love of the story, everyone loves to tell stories. And that's what life in Kali Yuga has been about. And even high culture literature that people occasionally still read. I don't think there are too many readers. But cinema has become the new way of transmitting stories. And people love to watch these and cry when their heroes and heroines are going through sad moments. And people live vicariously through the stories that Hollywood and other studios produce for you and make a lot of money filling your emptiness with another story. If you're running away from that emptiness, you'll never find the fullness in a story. So that's the attachment that has to be let go of, and it's not so easy because we love our imaginations and we love to have some sense of the lives of others, to know if our lives are interesting or we're missing the boat because we could be doing what these people are doing. And people love to compare and compete and all of those things. My story's better than your story, so all of this whole realm of the currency of trading stories, which is most of what social relationships are about at the ego level, and most of the stories are not even true. They're always mixed with little fabrications and whitewashing of the past and omissions of certain things that aren't to be shared, etc. So it's freeing yourself of that sanskara, that tendency of being a character in a story and wanting to identify with other characters and other stories. That's what keeps us, I think, attached to the plane of illusion. And the real truth is better than any of these stories. That's what people are missing out on, So find the real through line of the theodrama and the ultimate destiny that you can connect to through the truth that comes from the silencing of the ego stories, and that brings the great bliss, Mahasukha, which the stories will never accomplish.